Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode of How This Is Building Me, host D. Ross Kamage, MD, PhD, of the University of Colorado, sits down with his former patient, Melissa Turner, a patient with lung cancer who is receiving hospice care, to discuss her perspectives on the care she has received and the connections she has made throughout her cancer journey. Dr. Kamage and Melissa, who defines herself as a mother, grandmother, and wife, reflect on the bond they share as oncologist and patient, the nuances of Melissa's transition to hospice care, and the importance of authentically framing her cancer narrative as one where challenges, grief, and gratitude can coexist.
Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and I am the host of How This Is Building Me, the podcast that deals with the ups and downs, highs and lows of all of those who personally or professionally have had their lives touched or involved caring for those with cancer. And to really extend out the full meaning of that introduction, I'm so excited to have our next guest today, Melissa Turner. So Melissa, would you like to introduce yourself in any way that you think is appropriate?
Hi everyone, I'm Melissa Turner. I was a patient of Dr. Kamage's for 5 years. He kept me alive for 5 years, even with a stage 4 lung cancer diagnosis. I am now a hospice patient. I am a mom of 2 adult daughters and a grandma of 3, which just lights my heart.
That's pretty impressive. That's a good start. So we've kind of like, we've done the foreshadowing. We know you're going to end up in hospice, and you define yourself, I think, very appropriately by your relationships with other people. Have you always defined yourself that way, or is that something that has changed as you sort of enter the end of your cancer journey?
Yeah, I think I've always defined myself as being somebody's mom, and now I have the great honor and excitement to be somebody's grandma too.
And when did the grandkids arrive? Fairly recently, wasn't it?
Well, the first one arrived the day after we did the last podcast, 2.5 years ago. And the newest ones are 3.5 months old. They're cousins, and they were born 7 hours apart.
That's just amazing. That's pretty organized on behalf of your daughters to actually coordinate like that. So they're, what, in their 30s, I think you told me?
My youngest one will be 30 next week, and the oldest one is 36.
So tell me a little bit more about Melissa Turner. Where did Melissa Turner, well, she wasn't called Turner then, but where was she born and brought up?
I was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana, so technically I'm a Hoosier. Family moved to upstate New York, and then when I was in first grade, we moved to Arizona. So I actually grew up in Phoenix and Scottsdale. Decided that I liked the change of seasons and went to the University of Denver for college and never moved.
What did you study at the university?
Psychology.
Ah, explains a lot, but we'll get to that. So when did you meet Jim, your husband?
After I graduated from college, I went on that, backpacking thing through Europe for 3.5 months, and actually spent a month in Cambridge with my aunt and uncle, the one who prays for you, and came back and my roommate was dating his roommate.
Hold on, your roommate was dating? Oh, yes, not him. So that's okay. You didn't steal someone then?
Right, no, they broke up and Jim and I didn't.
Good. I really like Jim. He's a great guy. Well, I didn't need to tell you that. You already know that.
I'll tell him.
Your experience with cancer predate your diagnosis of lung cancer. So let's touch a little bit on, how cancer first got into your life or you became aware of it. And it may not have been in you. Maybe it was in other relatives first.
No, I was the leader, unfortunately. So my oldest daughter was 8 months old. I know the date. It was August 20th, 1987. I went in to get a lump removed in my breast. And at that time, they figured out very quickly that it wasn't just a benign lump, it was a cancerous lump. And I remember every detail of that. I was 29, so really young. I had one doctor tell me that it never happens with somebody that young, but clearly it did. And I think women are getting diagnosed earlier now, which is good. So I went through 6 months of chemo and 6 weeks of radiation.
And then when did they figure out that you were a BRCA carrier?
In 2000, I took the genetic testing through some program with Komen and the University of Colorado.
And was that just because you went, hey, I was young and I had breast cancer? Or was there any kind of a family history at that point?
No, there wasn't a family history at that point at all.
Okay.
It was after I got my results that my sisters and cousins did their genetic testing, and a lot of them found out that they also were BRCA positive and went ahead and did, you know, the preventative surgery to hopefully mitigate their risk.
And you had the preventative surgery too?
I did, yeah, when I was about 40.
You had a bilateral mastectomy. Did you have your ovaries taken out too?
I had the whole thing chopped out.
All right, yeah, okay. And we can talk about how cancer is a shock, but the idea that you've got some predisposition and then that may also be something that affects your family, both upstream and downstream of you. So talk me how you process that. Tell me what went through your head when you suddenly realized that, you know, you had an inherited thing. So it's not just about you and your risk. It's about your family and your daughters and everything else. How do you deal with that?
You should ask, because just a few minutes before I jumped on this call, I was giving my oldest daughter a little bit of backstory. I'm taking advantage of this time I have in helping my daughters understand more about me as a person versus a mom. Yep. And it literally was just sending my oldest daughter a note talking about my cousin, who I'm just actually now just getting to know. Her father, my blood uncle, died of pancreatic cancer, which is, if you have a BRCA positive genetic history, you are at more at risk of pancreatic cancer. In the note, I asked her, I said, please get screened. So really push the screening to make sure that if anything happens, it's caught early. One of my daughters, my oldest daughter, did a bilateral mastectomy about 7 years ago. The other one didn't.
Okay.
And push her to get screened. If nothing else, just be really disciplined about getting screened twice a year. So again, if something happens, they're able to catch it early.
Did they have the genetic test done?
They did.
And did they have that done fairly early on, or did it take some time? Because when you figured out that you were a BRCA carrier, your girls would have been in their late teens, early 20s?
Like 22 years ago. So they would have been in their teens, yeah.
Yeah, they would have been in their teens. So technically, did you make the decision to have them screened, or did you have a discussion with them, or did they make the decision?
It was all them. I didn't want to push anybody to get screened if they didn't want that information, but they did. Okay. And my niece, she got tested, and she last year had a bilateral mastectomy, and she's almost going to be 31.
Early on, I think you kind of embraced aspects of your association with the breast cancer community by, I think, becoming a very active advocate fundraiser for Komen. Did that happen immediately, or did you kind of evolve into that?
The very first race for the cure here in Denver was over at Wash Park, which is, as you know, a block from my house. And there were 1,500 people who attended that one. And we decided, hey, you know, we'll just jump on this. So that would have been fall of 1993.
And have you done most of them?
I've done all of them.
Wow.
There were a couple. We were in Italy one time, so I missed that one. But at that race, they had some sort of postcard that had some question. I can't remember what it was now. I filled it out, and they picked me out of the crowd and asked me to become involved. I did immediately. I did some sort of radio interview and got to meet the person who was coordinating all the Denver efforts and got pulled into it. So it was right away. I was okay. In the planning committees. I led one of the groups and fundraised the whole time.
I think one of the fascinating things I've learned about you is, you know, when you walk into the room, you don't go, oh my goodness, Melissa's here. You know, there's this huge personality well, hold on, just control your ego for a second here. But you're not this huge personality that's sort of bombastic. And yet you are this kind of incredibly strong force that you just sort of do what I think you view as right. And it's actually very compelling. People follow your lead because of your conviction and not because of your volume. That was a compliment, by the way.
Well, thank you.
So here you are, you know, you're, you know, poster girl for BRCA screening, prophylactic surgery, you're a fundraiser for Komen, and, you know, there's a gazillion photographs of you in pink tutus, you know, all over the internet. And then, you know, what happened with lung cancer? Where did that come from?
Where did it come from?
There's some vague association with BRCA, but it's not terribly strong. So the other possibility is you're just unlucky and you just got two completely separate things. And we should point out that you're not a smoker, although that shouldn't be part of the first question anyone asks about lung cancer.
I got diagnosed in, well, the official date is February 8th, 2018. But for almost a year before then, I was having shoulder pain, back pain, kind of lower abdomen pain. But I was also hiking every week. I had joined an urban walking group. So 3 days out of the week, I was out and about hiking and or walking, you know, significant distances. And we just assumed it was some sort of muscle related thing because the pains were not, I mean, they were in my shoulder. I mean, I didn't know that was associated with lung cancer, and neither did any of the providers, or at least they didn't think about it, probably because I didn't smoke. So it didn't make any sense. So I went to every provider imaginable, massage, acupuncture, Pilates, you know, I just did all sorts of things trying to figure out how to deal with my muscles. But at night the muscle in my abdomen would spasm and I'd have to get up and exercise it out. As it turns out, I think I was just relieving the pressure on whatever nerve that was. Yeah. So it took me a really, really long time to figure out what was going on. Finally, in January of 2018, I went to a back doctor I used to deal with some of the spine stuff I've got going on. And he said, well, let's do an MRI because you had breast cancer. So he was thinking maybe the breast cancer had returned.
Yeah.
And through the MRI, it came back that, no, that's not what it was. It was one of three things, pneumonia or something else or cancer. That was when the light bulb hit. And I actually then went to the cancer group that dealt with my breast cancer and got matched with their lung cancer doctor. And then you came along and I switched.
Do you want to tell the story about our scheduler who hounded you? I think it's a funny story. So we had this wonderful scheduler. And for those listening who are practitioners, you know, we all know a scheduler is kind of like the shop window of your medical practice. And so a bad one is kind of like, you know, nobody comes to see you, and a good one can be amazing. And I think our one, who was called Bethy, was just amazing.
She was amazing. And she contacted me so often, she actually kind of annoyed me.
Well, so what, you'd reached out and then she was just trying to return your phone call or something?
No, I didn't reach out. My cousin in Washington, D.C., when she found out that I had lung cancer, contacted a good friend of theirs who was an endocrinologist and asked if he knew anybody in Denver who was a lung cancer doctor. He said no, he didn't, but he knew somebody in Denver who would know a lung cancer doctor. So it came through this little magic of, you know, the world being so incredibly connected.
Yeah.
So they sent you an email saying, we've got this patient, blah, blah, blah. She's BRCA positive. And I have that string of emails, and I think it took you all of 2 minutes to respond to say, yeah, I'll see her. And then Bethy started calling, leaving me messages, trying to get me in. But at that time, I had already started down the path of being treated at this other organization. Finally, I looked you up. And my comment to my cousin was, they must be a brand new doctor, this Kamage guy, because who recruits for their patients? He must be wanting to fill his practice. And
yeah, desperate.
Desperate, exactly. That's So I thought you were a brand new doctor trying to get patients. And so I totally ignored her and I ignored you. And we weren't terribly pleased with the other doctor I was seeing. And I looked you up and went, holy crap, this guy doesn't need patients. He's the top guys. And so I switched. I got in touch with her and she got me in, and it's just history, as they say.
Yeah. And if it's any consolation, I have absolutely no memory of that whatsoever. Well, I was thinking about this on the drive in. I was trying to remember when you transitioned in my head from any other patient, and we try and treat all patients with respect, but when something changed in our relationship. And I don't know whether you initiated it or I initiated. I had this sneaking suspicion it was when you started to send me pictures of your trips, but I don't know if your recollection is the same.
Well, since I don't know how you interact with other patients, I don't know that I'm a good judge of when it changed.
Because it's always been like that. I guess so. Well, so, you know, I think we try and treat all patients the same, but so it comes the other way. I tailor my interaction depending on the audience, as it were. And some people view me essentially as a car mechanic and, you know, have that very professional and sort of distant relationship. And they just want to know how the car, their body is working. And then thanks very much, they're going to get on with their lives. But somehow with you, you know, again, this is one of your tremendous strengths, is that those barriers sort of don't exist for you. And I had this impression that, you know, you started to tell me about where you're going to go on vacation, and some of them were kind of bucket list places. Mm-hmm. And then you started to send pictures. I remember, for some reason, I remember the Africa trip where you started to send me pictures of zebras, sort of going, I wouldn't see the zebra without you.
Yeah, that's right. So Africa was the first international trip we did after starting seeing you. And so I started sending you vacation pictures because of you and the care you're giving me and the trial you put me on that was successful for me. I was able to do these trips. And so that was my way of saying, you know, you're coming along with me, even though you're not physically here, you're coming along with me to these incredibly wonderful places that I may not have been able to visit had it not been for your care. So that was my initial rationale for sending you those Africa trips, which happened not long after I began seeing you. April of 19, I think.
Okay. And then I think somewhere in me, it was like as if you had stepped forward and then I stepped forward too. And so it was a kind of mutual decision. And it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek. So I can't remember when I first got your zebra pictures, but I have a sneaking suspicion I was away at a conference somewhere. And I just took a picture on my cell phone and sort of said, well, here's the view from the inside of the cab on the way to Barcelona Airport.
Yep.
And that became our way of communicating. The people listening should know you're actually an incredibly good photographer and it's one of your passions. Whereas mine was kind of like, and here are my feet at the airport. You know, they always sort of say most communication is nonverbal. And that was kind of a nonverbal communication of just sort of mutual respect and affection, I think.
So do you send those crazy pictures to other patients?
No, that's our thing.
Awesome.
Let's talk a little bit about how that relationship involved, and not everybody who's one of my patients gets an article written about them just because they're so generous in terms of gifts, but you got an article written, not by the oncology group, but by the intensive care unit group. First of all, we should touch on how COVID was particularly hard for you. And then how you kind of expanded your umbrella of people you influence in the hospital here with the pulmonology group. And then I want to get into your particular gift-giving expertise.
I'm not sure COVID was any harder for me than anybody else, but I was getting chemotherapy. So, you know, I guess I was a bit more at risk than somebody who had a really good immune system. But I had met Dr. Mark Moss, who's the head of pulmonology, at a University of Colorado fundraising event in February of 2020. He also was the head pulmonologist for the ICU unit. And then during the summer, when, you know, COVID started hitting, I reached out to him. I found his email and reached out to him and just said, hey, I'm just thinking about you. How are things? He said, things were really hard. And I responded and asked, how can I help? So out of that, I said, I'm going to be there in next week. Can I bring the team treats and cookies? And he said, oh my gosh, they would love that. So in December of 2020, I started bringing cookies and treats and brownies and candy and all sorts of other things every time I came in for treatment, which at the time was every 3 weeks. And I would bring a bunch for the ICU unit, and I'd meet Mark or somebody else and they would bring it back. But then I also thought, well, if I bring stuff for them, I should bring stuff for Dr. Kamage and that team because they're keeping me alive. So it wound up being a 2 year long activity that I got a lot of benefit from. I was able to meet people I wouldn't have met through the ICU and that connection. And Mark and I are now friends, as well as a couple of their nurses and me. And I just hope I was able to bring just a little bit of comfort and joy to a group that was working super hard, and to your group as well.
You know, there's that expression, it's the little things. I remember we were discovering different flavors of Oreos, and we had the excitement of carrot cake Oreos being discovered. The beauty is that we don't expect it, but we do appreciate it. We spend most of our time trying to do the right thing and thinking about people. And honestly, it always comes over as a slight surprise that anyone thinks about us in return. And so it kind of is a slightly humbling experience. One of the things is when you would come for your chemotherapy, the thing that always struck me is there is this rotating series of people who are almost fighting to come and be your companion on that day. And so I don't know that I've seen people who have such good friends and so many of them. I mean, it's not like, we scraped the bottom of the barrel. They were all fantastically engaging and they all loved being with you. And I think that's testimony to, whatever your secret sauce is, that you provide something for people, whether you know it or not. So when you got diagnosed with lung cancer and you started to go on chemo, how did you assemble the pit crew who, would rotate through coming with you? I don't think you ever came on your own.
The only times I came on my own were when the university wouldn't allow guests.
During COVID, yeah.
Yeah, so there, I think, were two or three times when I had to be on my own. And then the one time that I reacted to Keytruda was one of those times I was by myself. So it did happen, but I didn't actively pull people together. They just volunteered to go with me. And I think once I had five people with me, and they brought picnic lunch because I was there for hours. One time we got in trouble because we were too noisy in the infusion room. But the nurses would come and tell me that they loved the energy coming from my infusion bay because I always had friends with me. And I mean, that was just a really delightful way. But I didn't actively pull anybody together. I didn't have to.
I mean, I don't know. You'll have to tell me whether this is true, but I have a sneaking suspicion that you've been paying forward all your life, and all of these other people went, well, this is my chance to return some of those favors.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know if they thought about it as returning anything, but
Sometimes we just do the right thing, whether we know why we do it or not.
during those last few weeks when I told you I have a revolving door of lovely friends and family who have come to visit, and it's just been a really nice opportunity to spend time with my friends.
We transitioned to hospice because we had essentially run out of things that were working, including experimental stuff and trials. And you were getting, to some extent, more beaten up, and pain was becoming an issue. And we started to involve the palliative care team to help with pain. We started to have discussions about, well, do we want to spend what time we have having more therapy with side effects that may or may not be effective, but probably wasn't going to be effective? But can you remember what that transition time was like? I mean, I knew it took, many conversations to bring up the idea of hospice. And then was it forced on you? You were cracking jokes about me kicking you out, but you can tell me if you felt it was forced on you or whether it felt appropriate.
Maybe a little forced. When I saw the palliative care doctor join us in our sessions, our appointments, I knew that he was not overtly pushing hospice, but also pushing it. So I felt that whether he was or wasn't, I don't know. I just felt like he was strongly thinking that that was what I needed to do. And that felt a little uncomfortable, honestly.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, I also understood that there really wasn't a lot of other options for me. And the fact that regardless of what I did next, I wasn't going to be able to reverse the damage that cancer has already done to my body. So I agreed, I think, a little reluctantly to join hospice. But the one thing that I wanted to bring up and that makes it kind of okay, even though I'm not 100% committed to where I am currently on this journey, is that I know that if something comes up that might be reversible, that I can check myself out of hospice and pursue what I want. I have control. I still have control over the path I'm taking. And that makes me feel better that I'm not stuck where I am. I can try something perhaps that you think might be reversible, like the pneumonia. I just had pneumonia. I just recovered from pneumonia. And I know that had I already signed up for hospice, their approach would have been really different than the approach we wound up taking. And it was reversible and it's all gone. Their approach would have been, well, just let your body do what your body's going to do. But I was diagnosed before I joined hospice. And we worked on identifying what particular pneumonia I had and antibiotics that cured it. And your term, it was something that was reversible.
Well, let me give a little background to that, because I think it does illustrate that point about hospice and, you know, when it is and isn't appropriate. You know, these things are never black and white. But you had started to go downhill with what turned out to be a pneumonia related to you being on high-dose steroids to try and control the pain, which had been started by the palliative care team. And the pulmonologist had, you know, done a bronchoscopy and they'd found out what the cause was and they'd start you on an antibiotic. And then you still seem to go downhill very rapidly. And at that point in time, because there was this discussion about hospice that had been sort of going on but hadn't been finalized, this is where the medical team was not uniform. So the pulmonologists, having got the sniff that, you know, hospice was on the cards, were kind of like washing their hands of you, especially the junior doctors that were involved at the time. And the hospice doctors were kind of like, well, we're heading to hospice, so, you know, we're all going to the same place. It just might take us a little time to go there. And I have to say, behind the scenes, I was, if I can just be honest, I was pretty pissed with what was going on. And I don't usually get angry, but I was, because I felt that what had happened was that the steroids that they'd had you on that were keeping you stable, they had tailored them off very rapidly, and that was the cause, and that potentially this was reversible if we could get you back up. You were starting to be out of it, and so I was talking to Jim, because, you know, you don't want to be in the middle of all of this. But I pushed very hard to say, look, I know you've signed up for hospice, but you've got the steroids. Can you just take a really big dose and we'll talk about it later? I actually went and spoke to the palliative care doctor, who's a great guy, and I like him a lot. When I went and told him that I thought this was reversible, he said, well, you know, it's a different length bridge to the same shore, which, you know, is one of his sort of great analogies, which he says in this sort of beautiful deep voice, and it sounds wonderful. And I said, well, some people like the view from the bridge, and so they don't mind hanging out on it for a while. And I think fortunately we, you know, together with our team and with you and Jim, nobody got in the way of us pushing up the steroids, and fortunately that seems to have fixed you, because you sound much better and much more with it.
Yeah, I feel good. I didn't know any of that background.
There you are in hospice. Okay, so when we started to talk through treatments that weren't working and we started to entertain the idea of hospice, I saw a different side of you. And I mean, despite everything that's happened in your life with all of the cancer and with all of the, you know, 5 years with lung cancer and everything else, is it just a shock to come to that, uh-oh, you know, we're nearing the end?
Yeah, it was a shock. I hate that I'm at this point in my journey. It makes me sad. It makes me think about everything I'm going to miss, including my grandchildren who will not have any memory of me because they're young. And I spent 5.5 years really not focusing on the cancer. I was focused on living my life and enjoying myself and traveling and, you know, doing all those things. So it was never something I actively thought about, except, you know, getting scan results. I mean, that sort of brings you back. And then all of a sudden it felt like all of a sudden it was everything that was driving every decision and every thought and everything I did. So I'm not sure what you saw change in me, but in November, when I landed in the hospital the first time, that's when I started thinking that my path had taken a very different direction. Then it just continued to take that direction. And
when we chatted the other day, I mean, maybe oncologists are always glass half full, you know, you have to be to sort of do the job. But when you're in hospice, it is a way of sort of shouting to the world, like, okay, this is serious. And, you know, does it become a means of having conversations, you know, with friends and family that you'd put off? I mean, is there a positive side? And it's okay if there isn't.
There is. Absolutely there is. I can't speak for anybody else, but my daughters and I have taken this opportunity to tell stories, to tell backstories. I told them that when my mom passed away in 1995, I realized that I knew her as a mom, but I didn't know her as a real person. And she was not interested in talking. She was not, you know, she was going to beat it. And that was that, and had absolutely no interest in sharing or answering some of my questions. I mean, simple things like I didn't even know what her favorite color was or her favorite flower. I felt that that was just a huge loss that I hadn't taken the opportunity to find out more about her. And so that's what I've told my kids. I said, here's an opportunity, if you're interested, maybe you're not, for me to share who I am and some of the backstories that maybe drove some of who I am today. I mean, it's been a really wonderful opportunity, and probably we would not have slowed down enough to do that had I not now been in hospice. I've been going through, you know, some of the jewelry. A couple of years ago, I put together a photo book and a 30-page document to go with it.
That doesn't surprise me.
Right. Yeah. So that was, you know, pre-hospice, of course, but I had gone to a women's panel a million years ago. And one profound thing I got out of that was one woman said, you know, a piece of jewelry has two sets of values. One is the gem and the metal, you know, the kind of material monetary value, but the other is the backstory and why this particular piece may have been important. She said, if the ring gets stolen, it still retains half of its value, but it misses this other piece. So I took that as a jumping off place to go through, and I photographed some of my jewelry or some things that I particularly enjoy that maybe cost nothing, and documented it all so that they would have that. They would understand the backstory, or if they decide to get rid of the piece, they have a sense of what it is that they're giving up. And then since I've been on hospice, my oldest daughter's a teacher, and she's has a big planning block in the middle of her day. And she's coming over and recording some of the stories. Or at night, she makes a point of coming over with her kids. And, you know, we tell more stories. And I've been sending her text. This morning, just before we started, I did a long text talking to her about a cousin who our families were not close, but she came out. She was the first person who wanted to come out to see me. And unfortunately, we're, you know, in our 60s and we're just getting to know each other, but it was a really great opportunity. And I was sharing some of that information with my oldest daughter. So yes, the answer is absolutely. I'm finding, and again, I can't speak for anybody else, I'm finding that I have this wonderful opportunity, these golden moments to share some more about me with my kids. So they won't be stuck in that same, well, I don't know her as a person thing.
I mean, I think I invited you to be a guest on this podcast for a couple of reasons. So one is, you know, some of the people listening, you know, may work in drug development or pharmaceutical industry and have not actually seen a patient directly ever or for a long time. And so I want them to know that Patients are people who happen to be patients and not patients who happen to be people, if you see what I mean. And then the other one is, I did want to provide an opportunity to record you so that your family, including your grandchildren, you know, can just hear your voice. And for a kind of brief moment in time, act as if you're in the room with them.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. And I know they will as well.
As you're in this hospice phase, which, you know, we don't know how long it's going to last, is there anything that you're still wondering, anything you want to ask me about the time you have?
One question I've been wanting to ask you forever, and I never really found the right time to do that, and that's, as an oncologist, with patients, you know, that in some cases you've, like me, you've worked with me for 5 years and established a relationship that I adore. Hopefully you do too.
I do.
But you knew when I started that I was going to wind up dying from the lung cancer. Yet you still engaged in a relationship. So how do you, as a oncology professional, deal with the fact that your patient, you know your patients are going to die? How do you protect yourself emotionally with dealing with that on a week-by-week, year-to-year basis? And then when it finally happens, how do you protect yourself?
These things happen early in the life of an oncologist. And, you know, I don't know if I'm representative of an oncologist or not. So I can only speak for myself. But generally speaking, if you care too much about every patient, you cannot do the job. But if you don't care enough, you shouldn't do the job. So you've got to find that sweet spot. You know, last week I was on vacation and three of my patients died. And that always used to happen. It always made it very problematic for me to take vacations. And a very wise nurse once said to me, said, you know, the same number of people, you know, die when you're not on vacation. You just don't feel guilty about it. And some of the thing is, it's not just about the medical care. It's about the trust and the relationship. And so, you know, when I came back, the first thing I did was I phoned the surviving spouses of all the people and apologized for not being there at the end. But how do I protect myself? I don't know. I think I don't view death as a failure, because otherwise everybody's life is a failure. I think it's much more about what you're doing with the time you're alive. And, you know, you don't have to build the pyramids. You know, you can have an act of kindness with a friend. If I can give people the time and the quality of life such that they can either do or continue to do, in your case, the things that make them happy and the things that probably make the world a better place, then I view that as a success. So I wish you weren't in hospice. I wish we weren't, you know, looking at a timeline that we know is going to be relatively short. And yet, despite that, you know, given the cards that we've been dealt, I think if your passing can be peaceful, then I don't feel this is a failure.
See, and I'm not thinking about it as a success or failure. My question is, comes from a place of kind of the emotional piece.
Yeah, I mean, there are days when, you know, you come home and, you know, my wife and kids are there and, you know, it's kind of like, I can't do this. I just have to sit outside for a little while. And then you realize that, you know, life doesn't actually care what's going on, you know, in terms of, you know, big dramas. It's like you still have to have dinner and you still have to take the trash out. And so real life intervenes. And as long as you let it, it becomes this normalizing force. And so I think one of the ways I deal with it is I give it its appropriate space and its respect, but I try not to dwell on it because there's, you know, there's another patient the next day who needs me and my attention. And so I can't grieve in that sense. The other thing is, we have a very tight-knit team. And so this may surprise you. We talk about you behind your back, you know, in the team room. We grieve together in that regard. And it's not unusual that, you know, months or years later, one of us go, well, who's that person who did? And then we'll laugh about some funny thing that happened and we'll struggle to find the name. And then someone will go, oh, it began with a B. Oh, it was Mr. So-and-so. And then we'll remember. That's how we all cope with it.
Well, and then a related question, I know I've asked you once before recently, is How do you say goodbye to a patient that you've had for a long time? So me, for example.
Hypothetically, yes.
That bye when, your patient is clearly going to die quickly.
I mean, it varies. Sometimes for the people who view me as the mechanic, then, I'm just passing them off to the next car dealer, which might be the hospice, and they're kind of like, fine, don't let the door hit you on the way out. And I'm cool with that. I don't have to be the center of attention in anybody's life. Other times, you do have to have that conversation. I remember a few months ago, there was a lady I'd looked after for many years, and her husband said she's in home hospice, but she really, really wants to talk to you. And so I phoned them at home. It was just very important for her to say thank you. I had this little thing. She'd given some pills that she'd been on back to us, which is all totally illegal that we're not supposed to do, but you and the other 38,000 people will never tell, right? And so I told her that the pills that she'd given back, I was able to start somebody on therapy a few days or weeks earlier before their insurance would approve it. And she really loved that. It was the last positive thing that she did, and she sort of died the following day. And I've even done house calls. I've gone to people's houses. There was one guy, I remember, he'd lost his sight, and so he couldn't drive, and he was feeling very isolated. And I sat on the side of his bed, and I just held his hand, and we cracked some jokes. And it's really funny because his wife was a realtor, and she kept trying to sell me the house. And it's like, no, that's not appropriate.
All
So
right.
there isn't a uniform way. And for you, I guess this podcast is part of that. But as you've seen, I sent you pictures of my feet from the airport from my latest vacation. Even though the hospice has sort of taken over your day-to-day medical care, you're not kicked out of my clinic, and you're not kicked out of my life or, my thoughts. And so the goodbye doesn't really happen. I mean, I'm sure, you said this succession of people who come through your life in the revolving door of friends and relatives, but for each one, how do you say goodbye? Or do you just say, see you later?
Yeah, I haven't figured that out. I don't say goodbye and so see you soon. And I hope they come back and see me, that they don't think they just have one visit and then can't come back. Goodbye forever is not in the conversation.
I remember my uncle, who was my favorite uncle, who died when I was a junior doctor, and I went to visit him in the hospital. He lived just outside of Liverpool. And I knew it was going to be the last time I saw him, but we just had a normal day, and it was enough just to have spent that time together. We didn't have to make it, dun dun dun, important music because this is the goodbye. You just bear witness and be normal.
That's kind of how our conversations go. I hope that that's the way they feel too.
I wonder if in whatever time you have left, there are specific things that you want to do, see, discuss, talk about. I mean, do you, in the days or weeks that you have, what do you want them to be like?
The one thing I miss most in my current situation is having more independence and moving around the house, which is really difficult now. So I'm trying to use the walker and do things for myself. So that's absolutely on top of my list. But I also feel like my days are so limited and I'm not getting out. I don't want to be stuck in bed. I don't want to be stuck in this room. I want us to be able to go out and do things, but it's hard. It's really hard. It's hard for me to have the energy to do that, but we're going to try to do more of that, drive out in the Eastern Plains and just watch the world, So I'm not sure that was the answer you were looking for, but I just want
It
to regain as much of my normal life as I possibly can. But like I mentioned earlier, one of the huge benefits of this particular time is having friends come see me and spending time with them, and which has been such a treasure and such a blessing. And my kids, like I said, my daughter wants to spend as much time as she possibly can, and that's been a blessing as well. And I don't think would have happened had I not been in this awful situation.
Well, that sounds like a perfect note to end on.
Yeah.
Melissa, I knew it was going to be a great conversation, and of course it was. So I'm just going to say, until we meet again.
All right, and you're going to miss my pictures.
So much.
Melissa Ruth Turner died at home with her family beside her on July 19th, 3 months after this podcast was recorded. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.